Election interference. Did it happen? Was 2020 the great lie of Donald Trump? Or can it be disproven that Donald Trump and his team, they really didn't know what they were talking about? Maybe we'll find out that there was no voter fraud whatsoever. Maybe we'll find out that our election systems could be changed because maybe there are some things that are broken. Today, I'm going to be joined by Ken Block. He was hired by the Trump campaign to find voter integrity issues, voter fraud issues, to see if the election in any way had been stolen from Donald Trump. His book, Disproven, is a masterclass of talking about how data does not lie. So sit back, grab yourself a cup of coffee or whatever it is that you're into. You're watching and listening America Emboldened with Greg Bolden here on the America Out Loud News Network. Let's get emboldened.
America Emboldened.
Greg, I feel emboldened.
You don't know the founding fathers. You don't know what they did. You don't know what they sacrificed. We have lost touch with the principles in the Constitution. Nobody's read the Declaration of Independence. You are voting for socialism, and you got what you voted for.
Welcome, bold Americans, to another episode of America Emboldened. As always, I'm your host, Greg Bolden, here on the America Out Loud News Network, as well as streaming live on all social media platforms. Today, I have once again a great show for you. Yesterday, we had Dr. Peter McCullough talking to Kayla Pollack, and today I'm following up with the author, Ken Block. Now, Ken is a data specialist. He's an individual that lives in Rhode Island, has run for governor of Rhode Island twice. He's an entrepreneur. He is an expert in voter data and technology, and we are going to bring him right up to the stage and not leave you waiting any longer. Ken Block, welcome to America Emboldened. How are you?
I'm fine, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm glad. It's a pleasure to have you. Your book was put onto my radar about a week and a half ago, and immediately I read the title, I read the synopsis, and I said, I've got to pick up this book, I got to buy it, and then I got to get you booked as soon as possible. It just came out about 2.5 weeks ago, but it is your unbiased search working for the Trump campaign to try to find out if there was any election fraud. Tell me a little bit about how that conversation came to be. I know you document some of this in the book, and I don't want to tell the book to the people, but I certainly want to cover your story. How did they identify you in Rhode Island as the go-to person?
I'm not exactly sure. I have a reputation, a good reputation for having worked with voter data for about a decade. My work technologically is well known inside specific industries, gaming industry. My work looking for waste and fraud within social service spending programs is known for those people who track that sort of thing. I helped the state of Texas save $1 billion of waste and fraud in their food stamp program when we were working with that program in the mid-90s. And I did serve on President Trump's Election Integrity Commission back in 2017, 2018. And I had done a presentation up in New Hampshire to his commission about duplicate voting and the work that I had done there, which is probably how they knew to contact me. I don't know for sure. I wasn't looking to do this work when I got a phone call from one of the top Trump lawyers working for the campaign. His name was Alex Cannon. And he blew me out of the water when he just called the day after the election and said, we want you to look for voter fraud.
So I'm curious, in 2017, when you were first working for the campaign, talking about double votes, was there a narrative in the Trump campaign back then where they felt that there was an election integrity issue? Was this something that had started before 2020?
I don't know what the driving force was behind the Election Integrity Commission. I do know that I spent the day in Vice President Pence's offices, who had been given the task of making this commission work. And I was asked about a number of different issues revolving around election integrity, non-citizens voting, that sort of thing. And we spent a full day in the old executive offices building talking over integrity issues, things that in my opinion, were real, and a great many other things that weren't. So I don't know what the specific purpose was of that back then, but clearly the Trump White House was thinking about elections during that time period for sure.
Yeah, I have people that have been on the show before, and they're concerned that in some way, shape, or form, Trump has, and or his lawyers have, laid out a roadmap of both distrust and alternative ways to take the election. And not only are they worried about Donald Trump, but they're worried about Democrats using that against Donald Trump if he's reelected in 2024. And I think that that's valid information to put out there. I'm also a skeptic of whether or not our elections have been compromised as much as many people have told me they feel they're compromised. And your book actually helped me feel a little bit of validation in some of the points that I've been making, such as in the movie 2000 Mules that Dinesh D'Souza put out. Recently, they were unable to provide the courts any additional information supporting their claims. And I made the comment on my show. I said, if you have the smoking gun of information in your possession, if you're able to give Dinesh D'Souza this and make a Hollywood film, why not give it to the courts and out this once and for all? Can you talk about the need for validation from individuals within the campaign and what type of pressure you felt when you're going through data in order to say, just find the proof? Was that in the conversations?
Yeah, let's start with the last one first.
Sure.
As I negotiated my contract and before we had a draft, I wanted to make sure that Alex Cannon, the lawyer who reached out to me and was my main contact through all of this work, I wanted to make sure he understood a couple of things. The most important one being that in a decade of looking at voter data, I found nothing that came anywhere close to what I knew the campaign needed me to find in the swing states that were everyone knows by heart at this point. And the second thing that Alex told me, which again was really important and in hindsight, spectacularly great, he kept my company's identity secret from everybody up the chain of command in the Trump campaign, because he didn't want to expose us to undue pressure to deliver results that we weren't finding. And that was a really important piece of what he had done. Alex was absolutely committed to allowing my company to deliver a straight up analysis of what we found. And I was contractually obligated to deliver findings that would survive legal scrutiny in court.
Right.
So that it's a high bar to pass. And I've provided data like that in multiple court cases over the years. So know what I'm doing as far as bringing forward data to survive legal scrutiny. And that was an important contractual element, because I wasn't going to deliver findings that would fail legal scrutiny, because I wasn't interested in trashing my professional and personal reputations. I told Alex that if we went to court, if I had something that was good enough to go to court, it would stand up in court.
And you're somebody who has in the past been a staunch Republican as far as running as a governor. It wasn't until later that I believe you founded, what was it, the centrist party, the political party?
Yeah, that came first. Okay. I did that in 2008. That's a whole saga all on its own, including getting laws declared unconstitutional in federal court. I mean, it was a big thing. It's what launched me down the path that I'm on right now, really. And then after I had to get 5% of the vote to keep the party as the gubernatorial candidate, got 6.5%, found that I thoroughly enjoyed and was good at the debates, participated in about 50 of them. I had determined to run again in 2014 to build on what I had done. But I determined that it wasn't really feasible to do so with a third party. Right. Nobody got it. Even a party that was positioned as centrist, people look at third parties with suspicion. They don't understand it. They don't want to understand it. It's difficult to recruit candidates to run under third parties. There's a whole raft of problems with doing things that way. In Rhode Island, it's a deeply, deeply blue state, and the Democratic machine operates everything. I'm at heart a government reformer. I'm somebody who likes to see the status quo disturbed. And there was no way to do that from within the Democratic machine. And that left me as the only option running as a Republican.
Okay. That's good clarification. When I was reading the book, I know that one of the things I felt shaped your worldview of elections was the fact that you ran twice and you came within thousands of votes at one point in time in one of your elections. And it caused you to look at the voting differently. Because you said kind of humorously, I still wanted to punch him in the face when I saw him because I disagreed with him so much. But I understood, even in the hurt, where the votes were lost. You understood why people maybe went to a different direction. So that kind of led you down the rabbit hole, so to speak, of wanting to know more as to why people vote the way they vote, why systems work the way that they work. And I think that made you a great candidate for this study. As these legal cases were coming after the election. And so there's people like Sidney Powell, lawyers that are bringing the Kraken, right? They're bringing these huge lawsuits promising people, if you donate money to me, I'm going to find this fraud. We're going to get this. And she raised, I think your book mentions, close to $16 million on one of her fundraisers. She was unable to provide anything. And in your studies, you knew she would not be able to provide the smoking gun. Can you tell listeners a little bit about why you knew that this was going to be a fraudulent ability to be able to convince the courts?
Yeah, so evidence and facts that survive legal scrutiny have to be foundationally based upon data or provable statements. And so I was living in the world in that month of November 2020, where I had to deliver provable facts. And so many of the lawsuits that you mentioned, like Sidney Powell's, like Rudy Giuliani's, they weren't based on provable facts. They were fundamentally based on something called hearsay evidence. And hearsay is something that is a statement made by an individual that has nothing backing it up. And that's typically not allowed in our court system. It's not allowable evidence. And the best example for why is Rudy Giuliani's claims that Ruby Freeman committed heinous election crimes in her work as a poll worker in Atlanta, Georgia. It was straight up hearsay evidence. He had nothing to back up his claim that she committed these crimes. She sued him for defamation. He admitted he lied about it. And that's precisely that encapsulates why that kind of evidence is not acceptable. And almost, I shouldn't say almost, but a great many of the claims that are circulating around all over the place, ballots in a box truck being driven down a highway, ballots in a ditch, the lights going off somewhere, or the moon and Mars aligning just right, whatever it is, if he can't prove it outside of the statement, it doesn't stand up and it's not credible evidence of something that happened wrong. And that largely is what the big picture has been happening with all of the claims of election fraud. For the claims that got more specific about specific data elements, those are the claims that the campaign started sending to me right after I started work, having signed the contract. And my contract compelled me to look for fraud myself. I was data mining for deceased voters, for voters who voted twice, once in one of the swing states and once somewhere else. I had 21 million mail ballots to work with as far as the universe of information we were looking at. We had 35 days to do all this work. And then out of the blue, I started getting questions about, the first one was, hey, a funeral home owner in Pennsylvania says 100 dead people voted. Here's his list. What do you think? Right. And that began this never-ending parade of claims that were landing on Alex Cannon's desk. And as a lawyer, he had no way to interpret them or understand them, right. And he didn't want to. And he just started blopping them on me, saying, you know, prove or disprove this claim, prove or disprove this claim. And it happened on a daily basis. It happened over the course of weekends. And it went on and on and on and on and on. But the way he started presenting me the claims to investigate changed. Instead of tell me whether it's true or false, by the end, he was just saying, tell me why this one is wrong also.
And one of the things that shocked me when I was reading the book was I had no idea the turnaround time and how tight to contest election truly is. And you pointed out how little data is actually available in real time, that oftentimes it can be several months before data is turned over to the public. How difficult was it in order to get solid, hard numbers for many of these states like Pennsylvania, talking in Georgia? What are some of the challenges you're running into in getting the acquisition from individuals that probably were never asked to provide this level of detail to an individual before?
Yeah, well, there were two compelling advantages that were in my mind when I, as I considered whether or not to take this on. And the two were, I'd have the data resource collection capabilities of the Republican National Committee. So I didn't have to go out trying to obtain these files and mail ballots. They had every mail ballot file from every state and county in the country. It was already collected and it was in one place for me to get. That was terrific. And the other thing I had going for me was unlimited resources. The work I do is expensive. I have to use very expensive data vendors who provide and have access to very confidential and sensitive information. And on top of that, we had to do everything in a hurry because what a great many people don't understand about our system and legally in terms of contesting elections, your window exists from election day until the date that the specific state that you want to contest certifies the vote. And the longest window of that closed in maybe the first week of December. So what's always been puzzling to me about all of these court actions that have happened well after the votes were certified is that those court actions stood zero chance in any way, shape, or form of changing the election result. Because once the votes were certified, it's done. You can't do anything further from a straight up legal perspective. So all those claims and all those court actions that happened after the first week of December were pure political theater. They could never have changed the course of events because all the votes had been certified at that point. And the other really interesting piece of all of this that I hadn't really put my head around until I was immersed in it was this. First of all, let me state, I didn't find what I'm about to suggest. I did find, this is a hypothetical.
Okay.
And I don't want anyone getting excited who's listening. So imagine that I found 15,000 fraudulent votes cast in Georgia.
Okay.
I didn't, but imagine that I did. The margin of victory in Georgia in 2020 was roughly 12,000 votes. Mm-hmm. So let's imagine I found 15,000 fraudulent votes. Does this mean it's a slam dunk that a judge is either going to force the election to be rerun or, crazier, overturn the election results and remove the victory from Biden and confer it upon Trump? And the answer is no to both. And the reason is this. It's one thing to identify fraud. It's a quite another thing to legally show that the identified fraud harmed President Trump. And what I mean by harmed is that all of that fraud conferred votes to Biden fraudulently as opposed to Trump. Because we vote anonymously, there's no way that you could prove that those fraudulent votes worked against President Trump's interest and gave Biden an illegal advantage. And Trump lost a case in Pennsylvania straight up based on standing because he couldn't show the harm that would have been a foundational element of having a successful court case. So had I even found monstrous fraud, it's still extremely dubious whether that real fact could have yielded the legal result that the Trump campaign wanted.
So your book makes it very clear that repeatedly, as these emails come into you, as you get phone calls about this, asking to investigate, you know, 100,000 votes here, 20 votes here, that the issue always came down to having good data. That oftentimes when you looked into it, you're able to say, yes, these are the numbers. However, it's dirty data and therefore would never get past the scrutiny of the courts. And in many cases, I couldn't even find you enough votes of that dirty data, the duplicate votes as an example, where it would even make a difference in the election. But one thing that stood out to me is it seems like we definitely do have an election problem in this country. There's a lot of reform that after reading your book, I felt, you know what? We could do so much better. We could actually hold people accountable that are voting in two different states knowingly. And that doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat, because you pointed out that many of the cases, it was Republicans that were voting twice instead of Democrats. They were more likely in the data that you looked at, which I thought was very interesting.
Voter fraud, if the vote, the real voter fraud I've identified mm-hmm. has been bipartisan.
Yes.
Both parties take part in it about equally.
And when I watched Dinesh D'Souza's film, that's actually the takeaway that I took. People told me I was wrong, that it was all the Democrats and mail-in votes. And I said, well, no, if you listen to that movie carefully, they actually said both sides are cheating and both sides are trying to find their advantage, which makes complete sense to me. In a $2 billion industry every election year, you're going to have people that want to win extremely bad and find ways to get every opportunity to do so. So I'd like to know, if Ken Block could rewrite the way that we vote and create a more secure, proven method of an election, Ken, how would you handle future elections for the states? What needs to happen in America?
Yeah. A quick little piece of color. As I was putting the book together and working with the editor, he said to me at one point, he says, "You're really sneaky." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, you get into all the gory Trump stuff and you got that out there as the bait and everything, but you really want people to talk about this reform stuff, don't you?" And I said, "It's absolutely right. You know, if I'm going to get 15 minutes, I want those 15 minutes to not be focused in on relitigating 2020 again and again and again. Let's look forward and talk about the things that we should be doing to make our elections better. And let's get right into the core of the problem. The problem with our democracy today is the fact that too many of our elections are uncompetitive. What I mean by that is 80% of the seats in Congress, it's a no-brainer that you know which party is going to win the seat without regard to who the candidate is who's running under that party's banner. This happens because of gerrymandering, where partisan elected officials, usually legislative leadership, has the ability in every state, almost every state, to draw electoral maps with whatever whims they want. And they typically draw maps to advantage their party and disadvantage everybody else. And it doesn't matter. Republicans gerrymander, Democrats gerrymander. The commonality with all the gerrymandering is whoever holds the power is going to do this to help keep power. And I like to talk about this as putting your finger on the scale of elections, right? By gerrymandering a district so that a Democrat always wins it, or that a Republican always wins it, is the kind of democracy that we would expect to see in a third world country, not in the United States. And I use as an extreme example, democracy in Russia, right? In Russia, Vladimir Putin tips the scales by killing the people who run against him, right? Here, we don't use bullets, but we use gerrymandering, and the candidate is just as dead politically as the dead candidate in real life who was running against Putin. So gerrymandering is bad, 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 and it does terrible things to our democracy. It leads to more and more extreme winning candidates in the primaries, and it leads to gross dysfunction in Congress, where the two sides have no interest in any form of compromise, which is what I think the founders really wanted us to be doing politically, is compromising. And we're moving further and further and further from that. And I'm certain that the reason for that is our uncompetitive elections. And I'm going to just jump right into my favorite example of states doing things differently from each other and the negative outcome that comes from that for our elections. And while this is not the most important example that I'm going to give you, it's one that I think is most instructive in terms of people thinking, oh my God. And so here it is. Most states allow voters to vote early by mail, usually a couple weeks early. So imagine a scenario where I voted early by mail 2 weeks before the election, and then I had the misfortune of being run over by a bus before Election Day. And the question is, does that vote count or does that vote not count? And the insane answer to that is it depends. It depends on in which state you live. And sometimes it depends on which county you live within a specific state. In about a third of the states, the vote counts. In about a third of the states, the vote doesn't count. And in the other third of the states, there's no law that considers the situation at all, which is monumentally bad because whatever decision they're making in those states is being done without a foundation in law. So you could contest whether they count the vote or don't count the vote because it's not laid out in law what they should do. And I said it's not the most important thing, but some of your listeners are probably right now wondering, well, how many votes can this be? It can't be that big a deal. Well, in Michigan in 2020, a state that disallows those votes, they disallowed 3,500 votes. That's not a small number of votes.
Small number at all.
Right. And, you know, for me, it doesn't matter to me really if we disallow all of those votes or allow all of those votes. What's important to me is that everybody does it the same way. Because we shouldn't have a scenario like this where the voter experience is different depending on where they live and whether their vote counts or doesn't count.
Right.
So that's a big one for me. And there are many, many, many examples of things like this where Congress should step in and they should regulate these our elections as Congress is empowered to do by the Constitution and put some guardrails out there and guidelines. And in this circumstance, Congress should pass a law that says that either whether it's counted or don't count it, whatever it is, it has to be the same for everybody. We have states that are exempt from the laws that require voter registration. North Dakota.
Yep.
We have states that have squeaky clean data, really good data. Nevada and Georgia are two states that have really good data, which is surprising because they were at the sharp end of all these claims of voter fraud. But when you really get into what their data looks like and the activities they do to keep their data good, they do a really good job. And there are other states that have absolutely terrible data. And I'm going to give you two quick examples of it. May I just give you one quick example?
Please do.
New Jersey has really bad voter data. And when I looked at New Jersey about a year ago, they had 25,000 voters registered to vote with a date of birth of 1800.
How?
Now, that's not fraud for starters. It's sloppy, sloppy data and computer systems. You find computer systems where if a date's not known, sometimes they put the year 1800, sometimes they put 1850, 1900, whatever. It's called a placeholder.
Right.
But New Jersey has 25,000 voters with these placeholder dates of birth. And in 2020, 8,000 of those voters with a year of birth of 1800 voted in the 2020 election.
No small
that,
number
to
either,
me
right?
is extremely problematic.
Right.
Because you cannot identify anybody in this country based on name alone. You need name and you need a full date of birth. And even then,
you're still difficult.
You can't be confident that you have that person well identified. But without the date of birth or with a known inaccurate date of birth, you have no hope. And New Jersey can't possibly determine when those 25,000 registered voters are dead without a valid date of birth. New York State has a similar problem, much smaller in scale, for these impossibly old voters. They have they have thousands of them instead of tens of thousands, and hundreds voted instead of thousands. But New York State has a bigger problem, a much bigger problem. That problem is that while federal election law since 2004 required states to collect either a Social Security number or a driver's license for newly registered voters, that law didn't require states to collect that data looking for registered voters before that date. Most states have done a good job or a reasonably good job of backfilling that information. New York State has not. New York State has 3 million voters it cannot identify because they don't have the social or the driver's license. And what that means is New York State cannot determine in a good way whether or not those voters are deceased or not. In fact, This problem prevents New York State from participating with other states in a consortium that's dedicated to helping identify duplicate registered voters all over the country, because that consortium needs the social to do it confidently. Right. And with so many voters without that social in New York State, they can't participate. And as a result, this is a really important finding here. New York State has about 1.2 million registered voters who've been registered to vote for at least 20 years, who haven't cast a vote for at least 20 years. They're dormant voters. 800,000 of those dormant voters don't have socials or driver's licenses. Those voters are very likely dead. Yeah. And they've lost track of them. And those voters are bloating the voter rolls in New York State. New York State removed those 1.2 million voters that are dormant, and most of whom don't have socials or driver's licenses, voter turnout in the 2020 election would have increased from 70% to 78%.
Okay.
Just by removing the voters on the rolls who shouldn't be there anymore. So New York is, in my opinion, the worst example of bad data across the country. And there should be guidance here. The state should be compelled to clean up their voting data, not because there's massive voter fraud happening, but they should clean up their voter data because voting is core to our democracy. And we should have solid confidence that our election systems are doing everything they can to identify voters and make sure that their data is as squeaky clean as possible. And that's not happening in too many circumstances. And that's bad for election integrity.
Right.
So, you know, these are not difficult concepts. And in the computer industry, what I'm talking about, anyone who works with computers is nodding their head going, yeah, right. I mean, it makes sense. You can't have a database full of corrupted data. And yet our voter rolls in many circumstances are just like that. Voter rolls. Let's talk about, you mind having a quick conversation about getting a hold of a state's voter roll? Because this is a mind-blowing conversation too.
I do want to get there, but let's get to that. I have three areas I want to get to. Well, two, but I'm going to add that on as a third. I want to be mindful of time, but I would be remiss if I didn't bring this up. So one of the weak points that I felt of the book that I would like to talk to you about, just to kind of get where your mind was around this, is the mail-in voting. You had a lot of difficulty. When I read the book, you're like, you know, mail-in voting was probably one of the hardest things for you to be able to get the data and get it correct based upon some of these issues we just spoke about. But when I speak with individuals and they tell me, oh, I believe that this election was fraudulent, they always point to the mail-in ballots. They don't point to some of the stuff the Trump campaign was sending you. They say the mail-in system during COVID was a fraudulent system. Was a place where there was no way to properly identify and verify people were voting as they were intended to, that it could have been manipulated. How do you respond to people that use that as a claim and then make them feel better after reading your book, where that might be the weakest part that I thought as far as presenting the evidence?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge, and it was a massive challenge, is that state to state, and much more critically, county to county, in places like Nevada, in places like Arizona, you had different counties handling mail ballots in extraordinarily different ways. And the information, the data that was in their mail ballot files was dramatically different from case to case. It was very, very difficult to work with these data files in the compressed time frame that we had. And there were times where we had to abandon ship on some of them because there were just too many problems and there was just too much work to do. So yeah, it was a wholly, the chapter about mail ballot fraud and whether I could prove it or disprove it was I knew writing it, going into it, I was not going to be able to state with clarity that it was either proven or disproven because of the challenges. But here's the really important element of
sure.
The challenges I have, everybody has in looking at this data. Nobody has clarity looking at the mail ballot data. And for the people who are claiming fraud, the critically important element of our legal system, those making the claim have the burden of proof. The burden of proof doesn't fall on people defending against the claim. The people making the claim have to provide the proof that the claim is true. And in the case of mail ballots, I can tell you with certainty that dead mail ballot voting did not tip the balance anywhere. Duplicate mail ballot voting didn't tip the balance everywhere. And now you're in the realm of hearsay. Well, sure, but if signatures aren't being done, that must be fraud. Well, no, it is a statement of fact that signature matching is not the best way to do it, for sure. But that's not proof that fraud happened, right?
Right.
And every argument about mail ballots that you could dredge up from this point forward in this conversation is going to be much closer to hearsay than it is to fact, legally permissible fact.
Oh, sure. And so, in my show, I try to stay with the objective truth. I don't like it in the subjective and theories of, you know, well, what if this, what if that, which is what I enjoy about your book. But when you see all the numbers on election night coming out, Trump takes this lead, and it's almost a perfect curve in the votes through mail-in throughout the night that brings Biden back in. I think that that is a story, and I know that you address that even in the book too, how people need stories to help get into things. But I think it's a story that's worth wondering about, because here we are in 2024, and what has happened in order to shore up our elections, mail-in voting, and the reform that's necessary over the last 4 years? I mean, I have a concern that our democracy, our republic is in danger of being fractured over not having confidence in elections, which is why I think your book's very important. But I'm kind of curious, do you think that people are confident in elections right now? And if not, why aren't we publicly putting out what reforms in mail-in? What type of identification checks are happening at point of voting?
Right. It's all over the map because states do things differently. And this is another area that I would, and I'm not naive, but that I think Congress should step in and reach a consensus opinion on. This is really how we have to do things moving forward. Many Democrats that you talk to now who hold elected office that or appointed office that revolves around election administration will tell you privately, and they have told me privately, that voter ID makes some sense. And especially for mail ballots, where you don't have the in-person element of voting. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to have a stronger form of certainty that we know whoever cast the vote is the person who rightfully should have cast that vote. Ballot harvesting, where is actually legal in 25 states across the country. Legal. So anybody who talks about ballot harvesting is, well, that tipped the balance and everything else. Well, in a state where it was legal, it wasn't illegal, right? It's not fraud if ballot harvesting was happening legally. Now, I think as a candidate myself that ballot harvesting is a miserable practice, and it absolutely creates bad images. And if our elections are going to be determined by whichever campaign can haul in the most mail ballots, it's really bad for our democracy, and it should be outlawed across the board. That's a no-brainer. And honestly, I think that is one of the compromise points where I think we can really get things going. Right. Your question about how can we be sure in this election coming up, there hasn't been dramatic change in terms of how our elections run across the country. We didn't really have a productive national conversation about what we should change and how we should change it. And I'm really hopeful, really hoping, that enough legislators at the state level and in Congress read the book, or at least hear about it enough to have some interest in it, so we can sit down and really start to talk about, over the next couple of cycles, let's put together a plan and let's execute it to solve some of these problems and bring our election systems from via computer operating them the way we did 200 years ago, which doesn't make a lot of sense, and fundamentally changing how we do some things to account for the fact that We're computerized. We're a much more mobile society now. And there's a great many things that we can and should change to make them better. How about a federal voter registration system and take the activity of registering voters by the states right off the table? If we did that change alone, we would solve a great many integrity issues across the country.
Yeah, the national election, especially, you know, when people read your book, Disproven, I'm going to hold it up here as well. That's the book. When you read it, you'll find out the counties are all doing different things. States have from state to state. You were going to mention something about that a few minutes ago.
I got about 4 minutes.
I know. And that's why I want to make sure you have time to say it.
One of my second favorite examples to talk about the insanity of how differently states do things is for someone like me who's interested in looking at voter data for every state. I can't, because there's 6 or 7 states that will not provide that data for any cost. Now, what's the cost of voter data? Well, large states like California, Florida, Pennsylvania, New York State provide the voter data effectively for free, or really small dollars, $25, whatever, something like that. No problem. There are states, one state in particular, Alabama, has the country's most expensive voter data, coming in at $37,000, right? I have not bought that data. So why does that happen? Well, because there's no standards imposed by Congress on what's a reasonable cost for the data. Alabama doesn't want you looking at the data. Massachusetts won't give you their state-based data. And then with what I imagine is a smirk, they'll tell you in the email rejecting you, which I got, that don't worry, we're not going to give you the state file, but you can go to every Massachusetts city and town and ask each of those cities and towns for their data. What they don't tell you in that nice email is that there are 351 of those cities. So it's a monumental job to look at Massachusetts' data. I haven't done that either.
Right.
So that, in terms of transparency, in terms of just fairness, and honestly, where Massachusetts and Alabama take gobs of federal taxpayer dollars to build these voting systems, how dare they make them inaccessible to the people who paid for them? So that's really where I'm at. We need fairer elections. We need to up our technical game. We need to get the states that lag in terms of how well their data is put together and maintained. We got to get their act going. We need Congress to step up and do some things, which is the hardest part about all of this. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we just got to buckle up and get through 2024. I know that there will be claims of fraud. Or they're already happening.
Right.
I will, as best I can, evaluate them in real time as we get close, from a completely nonpartisan perspective. You know, claims of fraud have only two possible evaluations, true or false. And those evaluations, have to be fundamentally grounded in, science and data. And, 'cause that's what the court system is going to demand, and right, we'll see. I'm optimistic and hopeful that we come out of this and we begin improving things moving forward.
It comes down to zeros and ones, right? It always does. True versus false. What's valid? What's illogical?
I'm an astonishingly and probably frustratingly logical guy. But in this work, you kind of have to be.
I think you have to be. It's very important. So I put the book up here. It's on Amazon. You can purchase this. As you can see here, I purchased it March 15th. Anybody thinks that they sent me a free copy and this is – no, I literally was interested in the book and purchased my own copy. It's a good
read. Feel free to leave a review, please.
Yes, I will. I have not done that yet. I wanted to speak with you because I wanted integrity-wise, I didn't feel it right to leave a review and then do an interview. I thought I should do it the opposite way. My listeners, if you're interested in this, one of the other things of the book that he does go into, but we're not going to cover it today because I want to leave something for you to think about, is he talks about why Donald Trump lost the election. The data actually shows it. And I found it to be very plausible. It made sense to me. I understood it. And in the context of 2020, it all added up. So Ken, great job putting this together. I'm sure you're going to get attacked by people that are convinced that your data is wrong. But as I like to say, the objective truth in data does not lie. or facts don't care about your feelings. And you're going to have to probably fight that crowd a little bit, but this is good work, and keep up the good work. And I'm really glad that you could make some time for me here on the show and my listeners. So thank you.
Great interview. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. All right, Bold Americans, that is our show for today. I'll be back next week covering a lot more material, talking about the headlines and things that are going on. If you enjoyed today's show, make sure you go follow Ken at Ken Block RI. You can check him out right on X. As always, you can give me a follow at Real Greg Bolden. And you can always join my Patreon if you'd like to support the show directly, patreon.com/AmericaEmboldened. I hope that Ken Block and I honored your time well today, and I'll see you guys on Monday. Can't wait for it. You've been listening and watching America Emboldened with Greg Bolden, my special guest, Ken Block, both here on the America Out Loud News Network, as well as all socials. Be bold, America.